You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiation Science and the Development of the Human Mind, translated by Anna Moise, and it is in Dr. Steiner's Collected Works, Volume 228. This is a report, not Lecture 5, which will be coming up later, but a report on Steiner's visit to England and Wales and the work done there, given in Dornoch on the 9th of September, 1923. My friends, tonight I want to tell you something about the journey. Tomorrow I plan to give one more lecture. The following week I'll have to be in Stuttgart, in which I'll go into some things which, as subject matter, relate more to the description of the visit which I am giving today. The visit started in Ilkley in the north of England, where a course on education was to be given, a course about the Waldorf School method and teaching, with reference to present-day civilization. Ilkley is in the north of England, a place with about 8,000 inhabitants. It is currently the fashion in England to conduct summer schools in such places during the summer months, and this course initially also took the form of such a summer school. It was to be accompanied by the art of eurythmy we have developed in the anthroposophical movement, and also by contributions of six of our Waldorf School teachers, always on the subject matter of the individual lectures. Ilkley is considered to be a kind of summer resort. It is, however, very close to the cities, which put one right into the industrial and commercial culture of today. Leeds is very close, and other places such as Bradford and Manchester are not far away. These cities absolutely reflect the life which has evolved under present-day conditions. One truly is sentient there of how much of our present age needs the spirit to come in. This coming in of the spirit should not be limited, however, to giving something to people for their immediate individual and personal inner needs. It is no doubt perfectly justifiable to see the anthroposophical movement in that particular light, but I am now speaking of impressions which today's outside world is really forcing upon us. You see, my friends, the situation is that one would feel it to be extraordinarily paradoxical in the cultural world if someone were to recommend adding indigestible mineral products, some kinds of minerals, stones, and so on, to human foods, considering it possible to add sand or the like to human food. The ideas which people have of the human organism make us consider this to be impossible. Yet, someone able to look more deeply into the way the world is made and the connections which exist in it, it is fair for once to say so out of genuine anthroposophical feeling and sentience, will in a particular sense be sentient of houses and factories put together in a style which may be said to do nothing to meet the aesthetic needs of people. That is the case in Leeds, for instance, where unbelievably black houses are lined up in an abstract way, and everything really looks as if it were a straight condensation of the blackest coal dust which has collected together and has come to create houses where people then come to live. Looking at this in conjunction with evolving culture and civilization, for the whole of humanity and in the same frame of mind as considering what I have just been saying about sand and the stomach, one really feels, one has to say, it is equally impossible for human civilization that such a thing permanently becomes part of the whole course of human evolution, and that civilization could make any kind of inner progress in that case. It truly is not a question of one ever being a reactionary and basing oneself on anthroposophy. We certainly must not speak of these things in a negative sense. They simply have arisen from the life of the whole of earth evolution. Yet within human evolution they are only possible if a genuine spiritual life enters into them, fills them, and truly enters particularly into these things, and gradually becomes able to lift them out into a form of aesthetics, so that people will not be completely removed from an inner humanity, because such things have become part of developing civilization. I'd like to say that it is exactly such an experience which makes one aware of the most absolute need for spiritual impulses to enter into our present civilization. These things cannot be taken to be mere general ideas which one has. No, they must truly be seen in connection with what there is in the world. One has to have a heart, however, for whatever there is in the world. Ilkley itself is a place the environs of which have the atmosphere, on the one hand, of these industrial cities being so close. On the other hand, there is something everywhere, though only in traces, which in the remnants of dolmens or cromlechs, scattered about of ancient druid altars, does remind one of ancient spirituality, though nothing remains that follows from it directly. It is touching, I'd say, if on the one hand one is under the impression I have just been describing, and on the other hand walks up a hill in this region where the atmosphere of those impressions can certainly still be felt, and where the extraordinarily characteristic sights, wherever they may be, one finds the remnants of the old sacrificial altars with the ancient signs on them. There is something extraordinarily touching about them. One such stone may be found on a hill near Ilkley, and on this stone, essentially, it is actually a bit more complicated, but essentially is the sign referred to as a swastika. This was carved into stones positioned in particular sites in the past, and refers to something quite specific. It indicates that these were sites where the druid priest would be full of the thoughts which, until, let us say, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, created the culture in these regions. For when you come to such a site and stand before such a rock with the signs engraved in them, you still find from the whole situation today that you are in the place where the druid priest once stood. The engraved sign would have made him sentient that he brought the state of mind that was in keeping with his position to expression in this sign. What do we read in this sign when we stand before such a stone? We read the words that lived in the heart of the druid priest. Quote, "Lo and behold, the eye as a physical sense sees the mountains, sees the people's dwelling places. The eye of the spirit, EYE, with the lotus flower, the swastika, the sign for it, looks into human hearts, into the inner soul. And with this ability to see, I want to be close to the people of this congregation who are entrusted to my care." Close quote. Standing before such a stone, one reads this, as it were, just as otherwise one reads the written text in a book. So that was more or less the atmosphere around the Ilkley conference. The program was that I would always give lectures in the mornings, where on this occasion I sought to develop Waldorf education and teaching out of the whole historical evolution of educational practice. On this occasion I started from the way in which in Greek civilization education grew out of the whole way of life in Greece. We may conclude from this that we should not invent special methods and practices for school, but that school is meant to convey what exists in the given culture. It certainly is not right, for instance, to invent special practices by the Froebel method in nursery schools. I certainly do not intend to be critical about Froebel, to do various things with the children. Those practices do not relate to cultural life in general, and have not evolved from it. No, the right thing is for the practitioner in education to be wholly within cultural life in general, having a heart and mind for it, and then bringing the life as it is lived, and into which the pupils are meant to grow later on, directly into one's methods of education. My aim, therefore, was to show how education and teaching methods may grow naturally from our life, which now, however, is filled with spirit. This made it possible to look at the Waldorf School method from yet another point of view. What I have said just now was merely a starting point. What mattered was to elucidate Waldorf School education, with which you are, of course, familiar. There followed a Eurythmy performance in Ilkley Theatre by the children from King's Langley School, and Eurythmy performances by the artists who had come with us. It would probably have been better to have the latter first. Such an arrangement would have made it immediately obvious that the Eurythmy done in schools grows out of the art of Eurythmy, which is part of cultural life. Well, these things will settle down in future, when even the external arrangements will demonstrate what is really intended. The third element, as it were, comprised the efforts of the Waldorf teachers who had come with us. And here I really have to say that they met with the greatest imaginable interest. I have to say that Dr. von Barreval's effort, for instance, the way in which he did it, was extraordinarily touching when the development of the Waldorf school is dear to one's heart. One saw Dr. von Barreval present his views on geometry as appropriate for children in such a simple way, using the method which you would surely know from his book on methods in physics and mathematics. The evolution, truly artistic, of the transformation and metamorphosis, suddenly and with inner drama, led to the Pythagorean theorem. And one then saw how the audience was taken along step by step, not really sure as to where all this was leading, with a number of areas moved around again and again until finally the Pythagorean theorem was beautifully illustrated on the blackboard. The audience, made up of teachers, was inwardly amazed, with thoughts and feelings developing with such inner drama and, I would say, such straightforward, evident enthusiasm for a teaching method that it was truly moving, as was everything our teachers presented. And it was met with the most extraordinary interest imaginable. We had brought along students' work, modeling, toy-making, painting, and so on. And there was enormous interest in hearing how the children work on such things and how it finds its place in the whole school curriculum. Miss Lemmert's demonstration of the way in which music is taught was followed with the greatest possible attention, as were the words of Dr. Schwebsch, the impressive, charming style of Dr. von Heidebrandt, then the forceful style of our Dr. Karl Schubert. All these things really show that it is possible to present the Waldorf school system most impressively to teachers. Miss Röhle then gave a Eurythmy lesson to a number of people, which rounded things off nicely, with the whole put together really well from the educational point of view. I am permitted to say so, for I had no part at all in creating the program. It was all brought together so well by our English friends that we really had a very good general presentation of the educational way of presenting subjects. A committee was then established during the conference with the aim of establishing an independent school on the Waldorf school pattern in England. The prospects of having this as a day school are really very good. King's Langley School had already declared themselves ready to adopt the Waldorf school method after my Oxford lectures the year before. As I said, the children from King's Langley had shown in the Ilkley Theatre what they had learned in Eurythmy. The interest and attentiveness shown with the Eurythmy performances, also warmly received, are something which can truly make one feel great satisfaction. This was the first half of August until 18 August. We then moved on to Penmanmar. Penmanmar is a place in the north of Wales, on the west coast of England, with the island of Anglesey to the west. Reader's aside, it's spelled A-N-G-L-E-S-E-Y, Anglesey, I'm going to say, end of reader's aside. No better place could really have been chosen for this anthroposophical undertaking. Penmanmaur is full of an astral atmosphere that comes to immediate experience. Into it have entered druid elements, traces of which may still be found everywhere. It lies on the coast where Anglesey is. A bridge goes across to the island, and this is a piece of real engineering genius. On the one side of the place, hills and mountains arise everywhere, and scattered through those mountains everywhere are these remnants of ancient, in quotes, sacrificial altars, cromlechs, and so on. Traces of the ancient druid worship may be found everywhere. And there's a picture, figure 6. The scattered individual places appear to be set up in the simplest possible way. Looking from the side, they are stones arranged in a square or rectangle, with one stone on top. Looking from above, these stones would be arranged like this, and there would be one stone on top, which makes the whole into a small chamber. Such things have, no doubt, also been burial places. But I would say that in earlier times, the function of burial places was always connected with the function of a much more extensive rite. Let me tell you without reserve what such a ritual site can teach us. You see, the stones enclose a kind of small chamber, with a covering stone above. The chamber is, in a particular way, in darkness. When the sun's rays reach it, the outer physical light stays behind. But sunlight is always full of glowing spirituality, and this enters into the dark chamber. As an initiate, the druid priest was able to see through the druid stones and see the stream that went down, not the physical sunlight, for that was blocked out, but the spirit and soul which lives in the physical light of the sun. This would inspire him with something which then entered into his wisdom concerning the spiritual cosmos, the universe. So these were sites not only for burial, but also for the gaining of insight. There is more, however. When the thing I have just described happened at particular times of day, we may say, at other times of day, something else was the case, for streams would also come back from the earth. And there's a picture, arrows pointing upward. And these could be observed when the sun did not shine on them. In them lives the moral qualities of the priest's congregation. At certain times, the priest would, therefore, be able to see the moral qualities of his parishioners in the area. The spiritual element streaming down, and also the spiritual element streaming up, showed him what he needed to be truly spiritual in his sphere of activity. These things do not, of course, appear in present-day scientific information on those sites. One can, however, see it directly, for the power of the impulses governing the work of druid priests at the time which was indeed their good time, the impulses were so strong that these things are absolutely still alive in the astral atmosphere in that place. I was also able to visit a different ancient site with Dr. Voxmuth. From Penmanmaur you walk up a mountain for about 1.5 hours. On top there is a kind of depression, see figure 8. From that depression, one has a marvelous open view of surrounding mountains, and also the boundaries of the depression up there. A site which may be said to be the actual sun ritual site of the ancient druids was found in that depression. The way it appears is that the corresponding stones were set up with their cover leaves. One sees traces everywhere. Footnote. According to the records, Rudolf Steiner said, quote, with their Denkblätter. This is a puzzle. The stones are standing stones with no lintels. If it had been lintels, he might have said Deckplatten, but definitely not Deckblätter. I have done extensive researches but found no solution to the problem. The word is made up of two elements, deck, which means cover, covering, and blätter, which means leaves. One possibility would be flaky bits caused by weathering. Both the original shorthand record and the transcript held at the Rudolf Steiner Archive in Dornach consistently state Deckblätter, and a footnote by Anna R. Moyes. Think of it like this. These ancient sites had no internal space. Up here you find two such Druid circles. When the sun moves through the heavens during the day, the shadows of these stones are at all kinds of different angles. It is possible, we say, to distinguish the ram shadow when the sun passes through the ram constellation, and then the bull shadow, the twins shadow, and so on. Even today, you gain a fair impression in deciphering these things of how the Druid priest was able to read the secrets of the universe in the different sun shadows, different in quality, as they appeared in this Druid circle. In quality which continues to live in the shadow cast by the sun when the physical sunlight is held back. A cosmic clock, telling of the secrets of the world, did indeed exist in the circle. They were definitely signs that arose in the shadows that were cast, shadows that spoke of the secrets of the world, of the cosmos. The second circle was like a kind of control, to check on the results of the first circle. If one could have gone up in a plane and far enough away that the distance between them might have disappeared, the two Druid circles would actually have given the ground plan of Argertianum. The location is close to Anglesey, an island where many things happened that survive in the tales about King Arthur. His center was a bit more to the south, but many things also took place here, which were part of King Arthur's activities. All this adds something to the astral atmosphere of Penmanmar, and distinctly makes it into a special place, something of which we may say that, speaking of spiritual things, we need to do so in images. The situation with thinking in images is that the images created as one speaks of things very soon vanish in the astral atmosphere within our present-day civilization. Seeking to speak of spiritual things, one is all the time battling against the disappearance of the images. One has to present these images, but they soon fade, and one is over and again facing the need to produce the images so that one has them before one. The astral atmosphere which arises from these things in that place is such that whilst it is a bit more difficult to produce the images in Penmanmar, the difficulties do, on the other hand, greatly ease spiritual life, the images once created simply looking as if they were written into the astral atmosphere. When you are there, you feel that if you are in some way or other thinking in images that reflect the spiritual world, they remain in the astral atmosphere there. This very circumstance reminds one, in such a lively way, of how those Druid priests selected the special sites where they could effectively, I'd say, engrave, as it were, in the astral atmosphere, the things which it behooved them to configure in images derived from the secrets of the cosmos. One does indeed feel it to be like an actual step taken, stepping across a threshold as one is coming across from Ilkley, which is so close to industrialism and only gives a faint indication of ancient Druid times, and now enters into something that is simply spiritual in the immediate present. It is all spiritual. We can certainly say Wales is a special place on earth. Today Wales is the preserver of a tremendously powerful spiritual life, consisting, it is true, of memories, but real memories, which are right there. The possibility of speaking purely about anthroposophy in this place, not in following its offshoots, but preeminently, is something I consider to be one of the most significant periods in the development of our anthroposophical life. We are indebted to Mr. Dunlop for making these arrangements, and now also bringing something of this nature into the evolving anthroposophical life. Full of insight, he has been working with energy. He submitted the plan for it when I was in England last year, stuck to this plan, and now had also brought it to realization. From the beginning, the plan had been to present purely anthroposophical subject matter in conjunction with Eurythmy in that place in August. Mr. Dunlop also had a third impulse, but it was not possible to achieve it. And we may certainly say that such things, as did become possible, only did so because of the genuine spiritual insight in choosing that particular place. I think it is of some importance to realize that there are such special places on earth where memory is still very much alive of the sun rites once performed in the north and west of Europe to prepare for the coming of Christianity. The lectures were given in the mornings. Part of the afternoon gave conference members the opportunity to experience on the spot the astral atmosphere and its connection with the memories attached to the ruins of sacrificial sites, dolmen, and so on. In the evenings, we had discussions on anthroposophical subjects or eurythmy performances. We had five of these in Penmanmar, received with truly great inwardness and also the greatest interest. Some of the audience were anthroposophists, others not. As one would expect in an area close by the sea, the weather changed from hour to hour, semi-cloudbursts alternating with bright sunshine and so forth. There even the premises were something rather like our woodwork shop here in Dornoch, was an evening when people really had to walk through a kind of cloudburst to get to the eurythmy performance. When the performance started, they still had their umbrellas up in the hall, but this did not dampen their enthusiasm. It really was something, and I did also say so in Penmanmar, which we call a highly significant chapter in the history of our anthroposophical movement. One event was devoted to a discussion of educational issues, also in Penmanmar. I would also like to take this occasion to mention the following, which you have already been able to read about in a brief report I gave entitled Das Goetheanum. When I arrived in Ilkley, a book entitled Education Through Imagination was waiting for me and captivated me quite extraordinarily, even when I first glanced through it. One of our friends in particular called it one of the most important books in England. This author is Miss Macmillan. She was actually taking the chair for the first evening, and those that followed in Ilkley. Miss Macmillan gave the opening address. It was uplifting to see this woman's marvelous enthusiasm and honest inner fire for the practice of education. At the same time, we felt an extraordinarily great satisfaction that this particular woman is fully acknowledging the things that can be achieved with Waldorf school methods, an approach to teaching practice based on truly serious intent. Having read the book fully in the days that followed, I summed up my impressions in the article which appeared in the last issue of Titel Das Goetheanum. On the last Monday, my wife and I were then able to visit the center of this excellent ladies' activities in Deptford, near London, near Greenwich. That is where Miss Macmillan has her day center. She takes the children from the lowest, poorest classes. She intends to take older children as well. Today there are 300 children. She started many years ago with 6, and today there are 300. The children come first when 2 years old, from areas where they are really dirty, neglected, sick, undernourished, or poorly nourished, if I may say so, with rickets, typhoid, and worse. Today, one sees a kind of school barracks in the vicinity, like those of the Waldorf School. Barracks, not our present opulent building, but provisional barracks, except theirs are well and handsomely furnished. They are in a garden, but you need take only a few steps out of one of the gates, and you'll be able to compare the people living in the most dreadful misery and dirt in the streets from which these children come with the way the children are turned out. First of all, the baths are exemplary. The children come at 8 a.m. and go home at night, so that they return to their homes every evening. In the mornings, they first of all have a bath. Then comes a kind of schoolwork, all of it with tremendous dedication, a touching sense of sacrifice, and everything organized in a practical way that is really touching. Miss McMillan also believes that Waldorf school education will have to be part of it all one day, and so one really has to say that from this point of view, too, we may regard that work with full satisfaction. One might perhaps wish to see some things done differently today where the methods are concerned. But in view of that sense of sacrifice, this cannot be a consideration at present. Things are always evolving. And it is truly significant how well-behaved these children then are, especially at meal times, when they are taken for their meals, serving themselves, with the food also always served by one of the children. What a practical approach can achieve is, for instance, evident in the fact that this heartwarming feeding of the children, so nice one would really like to join them, comes to 2 shillings and 4 pence a head for the week. Everything is extraordinarily practical. It was really lovely, for example, how they then called together the older children, who have been at the center for years, and they performed a long scene for us from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, showing real understanding and even a degree of stagecraft. It was moving, magnificent. How the children performed it, expressive and impressive, with real inner understanding of dramatic art. The performance of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream was given almost in the same place where Shakespeare himself and his players once performed for the court. For the court of Queen Elizabeth I was near Greenwich then. The Queen's courtiers actually resided in the areas where the schoolrooms are today, and also other rooms which I'll come to in a moment. There, outside London, Shakespeare had to perform his plays for the court. The children performed these scenes from Shakespeare's plays for us in the same place. In the same area and connected with this education center is a children's clinic, again for the poorest of the poor. 6,000 children are seen there in a year, not all at once, but through a year. Miss McMillan is also the head of this clinic. So, in a very poor and underprivileged area, a dreadful area, someone is using all her energies and doing truly magnificent work. It therefore gave me great satisfaction when Miss McMillan made known her intention, first of all, to visit our Waldorf school in Stuttgart with some of her teaching colleagues at Christmas. That body of teachers is extraordinarily dedicated. You can imagine that caring for such children in a way I have just described is not exactly easy. And so it gave me great satisfaction that this very person took the chair for the Ilkley lectures, and then in Penmanmar, where she came again for the few days she could manage, introduced the discussion on education, in which Dr. von Barreval and Dr. von Heidebrand took part. So, everything that took place at Penmanmar, and in connection with it, proved to be truly satisfactory. The last, as it were, the third part, were the days in London. Dr. Wegmann had come to join me for the work I had to do in London. We had been asked to present the method and nature of our endeavors in anthroposophical medicine to a number of English physicians. 40 had been invited, and most of them did also appear at Dr. Larkin's house. I was able to give 2 lectures, speaking first about the particular nature of our medicines in connection with the symptoms and signs of diseases and the essential nature of the human being. In the second lecture, I was able to provide a basis of a physiological and pathological kind for the functions of the human being. Then something on the mode of action of individual medicines, again in connection with that basis, the actions of antimony, of mistletoe, and so on. I think we can truly say that the subject matter was met with quite good understanding, also in a wider context, as evident from the fact that Dr. Wegmann was asked for a great number of consultations. It has therefore been possible to present this side of our anthroposophical work as well. In conclusion, we had a Eurythmy performance at the Royal Academy of Art, and it is fair to say that it proved extraordinarily successful. The hall is not particularly large, but it was not only sold out, people also had to be refused entry. The Eurythmy was received with extraordinary enthusiasm. We can really say that Eurythmy wins through wherever it goes. If only there were not those extraordinarily great obstacles today. On the one hand, one sees all the positive responses. For instance, the inclination shown by undertakings in Ilkley to have a kind of Waldorf school over there in England. But it is with great concern, and this is always with us today, that one sees the vague response, I'd say painful in its effect, which comes when one asks oneself, quote, what will become of the Waldorf school in a Germany which is in such dreadful danger, seeing that the endeavors in education have had their beginnings there, close quote. I am not saying this so much because of the financial aspect, but because of the extraordinarily endangered situation within Germany. There are things there where one has to say to oneself, quote, if it goes on the way it does at the moment, one can hardly imagine how things will develop for the endeavors, particularly concerning the Waldorf school, close quote. Ultimately, if things go on the way they are tending to go on, it will hardly be possible to take such things safely through the chaos of today. It is then with a heavy heart that one sees how these things exist after all. And all things in the world happen in a short-sighted way today, with people having no idea at all that spiritual streams must be involved in the development of our civilization, and that people far and wide have got out of the habit of taking an immediate interest in things and entering into them with gusto. Essentially, everyone is asleep, really, when it comes to the things which are so dreadfully striking at the roots of human and earthly evolution. Humanity sleeps. At most, people will moan about something that affects them directly, but things will not progress unless great ideas arise. The world is so unreceptive to the impulses that need to come in. People either do not want to hear, or they feel uncomfortable in their world when reference is made to such things as, for instance, the dangerous situation in Central Europe just now. They feel uncomfortable, do not like to talk about it, or add their own color and rearrange things so that one will continue to speak of things that have no point to them, of guilt and the like. That is a way of keeping things at arm's length. It can be really painful today to see how people relate to events in the world at large. This general culture sleep, which is spreading more and more, is essentially something which is most pitiful. There is actually no awareness at all of how the earth and its civilization are a single whole today. Even with such elementary events, I do not want to speak of them here and now, but they have in fact happened, as the great tragedy in Japan, a natural event that touches one deeply. If one considers how people would look at these things a relatively short time ago, and how they would look at them today, it is something which does again and again make one aware of the need to point out the urgent necessity for humanity to wake up. This is, of course, something one is always aware of, especially when one sees once again what could be if people were to take an interest, taking things not according to regional or national divisions, but in a general human sense. When one sees what could then be, and if, on the other hand, one sees how general sleepiness makes it almost impossible for anything to come about, this really does more than anything present the signature of our present age. That is the way things are. One cannot speak of just one thing without also getting the other picture for the given situation. Today, my friends, I wanted to give you a kind of description of the trip. Tomorrow I will speak about issues concerning the spiritual life, which are more removed from this and are really anthroposophical in content as a continuation. My lecture will be at 8 o'clock tomorrow. There will be a Eurythmy performance here at 8 o'clock on Tuesday. And that's the end of the report in between lectures 4 and 5.